is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I am Chinedu Ofor, and here's what's coming up.
The kind of security questions about data, and specifically how's it managed, who owns it, and how can governments that depend on private actors to provide them the technical capacities to initiate certain state.
That was Bulelani Jili, a cybersecurity fellow at the Belfast Center at Harvard University, who says Africa must be aware of the risks of relying on Chinese digital infrastructure and smartphones. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. Food insecurity is rising in many countries in Africa. New research by the Africa Center for Strategic Studies in Washington shows that while climate change is a factor, it is not the major cause of food insecurity on the continent. Wendy Williams is an associate research fellow at the center, and she spoke with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson about the latest study.
Right now, the largest driver of food security in Africa is conflict-related. Conflict is the primary driver of acute food insecurity in Africa, which is imperiling over 100 million people's lives.
Has that number gone up significantly in the past few years?
Well, it's doubled since 2018. So it's definitely trending upward. And most of this is all related to conflict, which these are protracted conflicts. They've been going on for no less than 4 years. If you consider that the 15 countries with the highest levels of food insecurity right now, 12 of them are experiencing conflict. And the one with the least amount of time in conflict has been Mozambique, which is 4 years. The rest are for, you know, over a decade or longer, like the DRC or Sudan, Somalia, and Nigeria.
Is the food insecurity situation in conflict zones because food is being used as a weapon of war, or is it because people are afraid to go into their fields to farm because aid workers don't have access?
It's more of the latter. You know, conflict, it distracts governments and draws away resources, right? The governments are focused on the conflict at hand, which in the case of Africa only adds to the fragility of the institutions and the infrastructure that exists, and the government's ability to provide public services and assistance. And so that's what's causing a lot of the food insecurity. And also the conflict, as you noted, it uproots people, which prevents them from going back into their fields to harvest or to plant. There are about 31 million people in Africa who have been forcibly displaced from their homes due to the conflict. And those people include farmers, pastoralists, fishers, merchants, traders. This translates into substantial losses in planting, harvesting, transportation of food, and the functioning of markets.
Now, I'd sort of like to flip that thought about, if I may. Mm-hmm. In countries that are peaceful but are experiencing food insecurity for other reasons, for instance, economic collapse, climate change issues, that sort of thing, does food insecurity increase the risk of conflict?
So this has been debated a lot among experts. And food insecurity itself doesn't create conflict. You see lots of places where people have been experiencing drought or poor harvest, and they don't immediately get into conflict. But it has been identified as an amplifier or a threat multiplier to existing conflicts or existing what would be a good example or way to describe
fragilities
it?
Tensions?
Exactly, tensions between various groups. So, you know, a common discussion is the problem of climate change, where you have shortened raining periods, so people are, the farmers go out to their harvest, and they've already had an arrangement with pastoralists who typically, under good conditions, farmers would harvest their crops and the pastoralists would bring their herds back into the emptied fields to feed on the leftovers. And it's sort of a good arrangement. But what happens when harvests come later and the pastoralists have to bring their herds back in from wandering, because they also don't have water or any vegetation out there, and they come back at the same time that the harvests are, you know, at their peak, but they haven't been brought in by the farmers, then you have these situations where that could lead to conflict. So it's more of an exacerbation, the climate change, or for any sort of tensions that possibly could exist.
That was Wendy William with the Africa Center for Strategic Studies in Washington. She was speaking with my colleague, Kate Pound-Dawson. Ethiopia's government carried out airstrikes in the capital of the country's Tigray region today, the fourth time this week, as the nearly year-long war intensifies. Government officials told news media that today's strikes targeted a facility near Mekele that serves as a, quote, battle network hub, unquote, for the rival Tigray forces. Residents in Mekele confirmed the strikes. There was no immediate information on any casualties. Spokesmen for the Tigray forces have denied that sites targeted earlier this week were related to the fighting. Health workers and other residents have said at least 3 children have been killed and more than a dozen people injured in airstrikes this week. Thousands of people have been killed since the war started and hundreds of thousands displaced. Aid agencies say hundreds of thousands face severe hunger because Ethiopia's government has blocked aid from Tigray. The government denies that and has blamed the problem on fuel shortage and actions by the Tigray People's Liberation Front. Chinese companies like Huawei and the Transsion Group are responsible for much of the digital infrastructure and smartphones used in Africa. Chinese phones built in Africa come with already installed apps for mobile money transfer services that increase the reach of Chinese tech companies. But while many Africans may find the availability of such technology useful, the trend worries some experts on data management. Mohamed Yusuf has more from Nairobi.
Chinese companies like Huawei and the Transsion Group are responsible for much of the digital infrastructure and smartphones used in Africa. Chinese phones built in Africa come with already installed apps for mobile money transfer services that increase the reach of Chinese tech companies. But while many Africans may find the availability of such technology useful, the trend worries some experts on data management. China has taken the lead in the development of Africa's artificial intelligence and communication infrastructure. In July 2020, Cameroon contracted with Huawei, a Chinese telecommunication infrastructure company, to equip government data centers. In 2019, Kenya was reported to have signed the same company to deliver smart city and surveillance technology worth $174 million. A study by the Atlantic Council found that Huawei has developed 30% of the 3G network and 70% of the 4G network in Africa. Eric Olander is a managing editor of the Chinese Africa Project, a media organization examining China's engagement in Africa. He says Chinese investment is helping Africa grow.
The networking equipment is really what's so vital, and what the Chinese have been able to do, specifically Huawei in particular, is they bring the networking, you know, infrastructure together with state-backed loans. And that's the combination that has proven to be very effective. So a lot of governments that would not be able to afford 4G and 5G network upgrades are able to get these concessional loans from the China Exim Bank that are used then to purchase Huawei equipment.
Data compiled by the Australian Strategy Policy Institute, a Canberra-based defense and policy research organization, show China has built 266 technology projects in Africa, ranging from the 4G and 5G telecommunications networks to data centers, smart city projects that modernize urban centers, and education programs. While the new technology has helped modernize the African continent, some say it comes at a cost that is not measured in dollars. China loaned the Ethiopian government more than $3 billion to be used to upgrade its digital infrastructure. Critics say the money helped Ethiopia expand its authoritarian rule and monitor telecom network users. According to an investigation by the Wall Street Journal, Huawei technology helped the Ugandan and Zambian government spy on government critics. In 2019, Uganda procured millions of dollars in closed-circuit television surveillance technology from Huawei, ostensibly to help control urban crime. Police in the East African nation admitted to using the system facial recognition ability supplied by Huawei to arrest more than 800 opposition supporters last year. Bulelani Jili is a cybersecurity fellow at the Belfast Center at Harvard University. He says African citizens must be made aware of the risk in relations with Chinese tech companies.
There needs to be greater public awareness and attention to this issue, in part because it's a kind of a key metric surrounding both developments, but also both kind of Africa-China relations going forward. We should also be thinking about data sovereignty is going to be kind of a key factor going forward.
Jili says data sharing will create more challenges for relations between Africa and China.
The kind of security questions about data, and specifically how is it managed, who owns it, and how can governments that depend on private actors to provide them the technical capacities to initiate certain state services.
London-based organization Privacy International says at least 24 African countries have laws that protect the personal data of their citizens. But experts say most of those laws are not enforced. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
A top UN official for Central Africa recently visited the Lake Chad Basin to assess living conditions in the area. Years of attack by Boko Haram have left much of the infrastructure there in ruins. Muki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Maroun in northern Cameroon, where civilians are asking for assistance in the fight against poverty.
François Lounsenifal, the UN Secretary General's special representative in Central Africa, says attacks by the jihadist group Boko Haram have diminished over the past 5 months.
Toucher la réalité, voir les conditions de sécurité dans la région.
Fall says the UN Secretary General sent him to evaluate the needs of communities recovering in areas where Boko Haram was active. He says the UN is mobilizing the international community to support the Multinational Joint Task Force, MNJTF, a regional military alliance, as it fights against the extremist group for a lasting peace to return. He says he is visiting Cameroon, Chad, Nigeria, and Niger to assess ways to start rebuilding and focus on reducing poverty. Those four countries contribute troops to the MNJTF along with Benin. Fall said the UN Development Program is raising funds to build roads linking Cameroon, Nigeria, and Chad to facilitate movement of people and goods. He said the UNDP is also helping villagers to plant trees. He said the UN Refugee Agency is helping displaced persons return to their villages, establishing lost documents like birth certificates, and providing funds for women to open businesses. The UN reports that a majority of the estimated 40 million people in the Lake Chad Basin live in poor conditions, partly due to Boko Haram's attacks. Mijiyawa Bakari is the governor of Cameroon's far north region on the border with Nigeria and Chad. He says civilians need assistance and are asking Cameroonian authorities and the UN to help them create better conditions.
L'activité économique était au ralenti. Le corridor commercial complètement à l'arrêt.
Bakari says that economic activity is picking up gradually after more than 10 years of inactivity due to instability caused by Boko Haram attacks. He says within the past 5 months, civilians and merchants have been traveling freely with their goods between Cameroon, Nigeria, and Chad. Bakari said although there is apparent calm, Cameroonian troops fighting terrorism on the northern border with Nigeria are on standby to protect civilians should there be a large-scale attack by the jihadist groups. Cameroon's government says it has allocated $300 million to reconstruct infrastructure destroyed by Boko Haram. It says that in some of the relatively calm areas, construction of schools, water wells and toilets, and dozens of markets and hospitals has begun. Officials from Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Nigeria met in Cameroon's capital Yaoundé on October 8 and agreed to work together to rebuild areas destroyed by Boko Haram. The officials said the Lake Chad Basin is gradually returning to normalcy since Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau was declared dead in May. Still, they said unemployment may be pushing young people to join the jihadist group, which continues to recruit in the area. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Marua, Northern Cameroon.
You are listening to Africa News Tonight. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Somalia's president and prime minister said late yesterday they have struck a deal to speed up the process for long-delayed elections, ending their simmering feud. President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed and Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Robo had argued over top security appointments and dismissal, a dispute that stoked fears for Somalia's stability. The president's four-year mandate expired in February, but parliament extended his term in April, triggering deadly gun battles in Mogadishu, with some rivals viewing it as a power grab. Under the country's indirect electoral process, regional councils first choose a Senate, which could be completed this week. Clan elders will then pick members of the lower house of parliament, now set to take place next month. The parliament will pick a new president at a date that has not yet been set. Uganda has kick-started a trial for the injectable HIV drugs cabotegravir and ribavirin. Researchers and those living with HIV say the trial will likely end pill fatigue, fight stigma, improve adherence, and ensure patients get the right dosage. Halima Tumani reports from Kampala.
Cabotegravir and rilpivirin have been in use as tablets. The World Health Organization last year licensed their use as injectables. While the two injectables already went through trials in Europe and North America, this will be the first time they are tested in an African population for efficacy and safety in an African healthcare system. Uganda is one of three African countries, along with Kenya and South Africa, which got approval from the WHO to carry out the trials. However, Kenya and South Africa have yet to acquire approvals to start their trials, expected by the end of the year. Uganda and Kenya will both have three trial sites, and there will be two in South Africa, with a total of 512 participants, 202 from Uganda, 160 from Kenya, and 150 from South Africa. Dr. Ivan Mambly, the lead project researcher at the Joint Clinical Research Center, says participants will need one injection every 2 months.
We're going to choose participants who are already on ART and are stable on ART, and we will randomize them to either continue on their normal treatment, which is the pills that they've been taking, or to switch them to this injectable. The injection is on the buttock.
Uganda has 1.4 million people living with HIV/AIDS. Barbara Kemigisa, who is living with HIV and founded the Pill Power Foundation working with rural women, says the injectable drugs will increase adherence to treatment and ensure people get the right dosage.
One of the things that affects adherence is the fact that people have to hide medicine. In the village, people are hiding medicine in the kitchen roof, in trees, in bushes, in a baby's shoe, you know. If someone is wrapping the medicine in like five plastic bags and digs a hole in the garden and keeps the medicine there, by the time someone is taking that medicine, it's no longer medicine but poison.
Nicholas Niwagawa, who has worked with young people living with HIV, welcomes the trial, saying it will reduce the pill burden and fight stigma.
Young people feel like this is a lot of pills to take. Those who are on the first line, they will have to take one tablet a day. They are also on second line, and they have to take more than one pill, and they have to take it in the morning and in the evening. And of course, this requires you to have actually a balanced diet, which is really a challenge for most of young people, especially those from vulnerable communities.
According to the WHO, there are 25.7 million people living with HIV in Africa, with only the pill currently available to manage the scourge. This injectable may come as a relief for people living with HIV/AIDS. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Eight foreign nationals have appeared in court in Cape Town, South Africa, accused of online dating scams in which vulnerable widows and divorcees were defrauded of money. Police swooped in on the alleged scammers Wednesday after a request from the United States, which has applied to extradite demand. Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town.
The accused, between 33 and 52 years of age, made a brief court appearance on Thursday. Eric Ntabazalila is a spokesperson with South Africa's National Prosecuting Authority.
In America, they are charged with wire fraud conspiracy, wire fraud, money laundering, and aggravated identity theft. The warrants were issued in New Jersey and Texas. The accused's fraudulent activities caused at least 6.8 million losses to American citizens and others around the world.
Yes, that is 6.8 million US dollars. Cybersecurity company ESET Southern Africa spokesperson Sean Pakade says internet scams have been on the increase since the start of COVID as more people are online. He has a few safety tips.
I think what's important is firstly to just be careful in terms of, you know, logging into these platforms, because these platforms require their data. These platforms require passwords. These platforms require some sensitive information, which could essentially compromise not just their dating profiles, but their banking profiles, their security at home, or anything that is basically connected to the internet.
He says people should also watch what additional information they share while communicating on the platforms.
So you don't really want to share too much stuff that would make a hacker or anyone that wants to compromise you be able to draw a picture of you and then be able to sort of tap into your vulnerability or even guess your password.
Pakade says you should also take a good look at the other person's profile to make sure it's authentic.
A fake profile you can create any time. You know, it's quite easy to create a fake profile because you just need an email. And to create an email is also quite easy. So, you know, to look at profiles, you need to look at, you know, how long this profile has existed. So you'd find the top of mind thing I can tell you now is that you'd find that, you know, the profile was created literally 2 months ago and this person loaded all these pictures in one day. So that's definitely suspicious, you know. Then you see that you're not really dealing with a real person because Facebook and all these platforms have existed for a while.
He says also be wary of meeting in person.
I don't physically have to steal your laptop or your phone, but there are different ways of actually tapping into your device when I'm right next to you.
Bakadi emphasized that red flags should go up the minute there is a request for money.
Don't fall for any stories about, you know, I lost my mother, I need money. You know, don't fall for that kind of stuff because then that's going to make you share banking details or share your ID or anything like that they might need from their side, because most of the time these suspects are not from where you're from, most of the time from international shores. They will then require additional information in terms of how to, you know, get money from you and what to send and how to send it.
He's appealed to people looking for love online not to let their guard down too soon.
How they are able to tap into that space and able to swindle people from, you know, not only their data, but from funds and money and all sorts of things is vulnerability. You know, they have to get you to a point that you know you're vulnerable, and then once you're vulnerable, basically they can literally get you to do anything. So people need to be wary when they delve into that space and tread very carefully and be very protective, not just on those platforms but on any online platform.
Ntabazalila says the eight accused intend to apply for bail pending America's extradition application. But South Africa's National Prosecuting Authority will oppose bail as it believes they are a flight risk and some are in the country illegally as their passports have expired. The state also believes they are likely to tamper with evidence electronically. Their bail application was postponed till next week. This is Vicky Stark for VOA News in Cape Town.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. For all latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. Tomorrow on VOA's Nightline Africa, Peter Clodish speaks with U.S. Assistant Secretary General and UNDP Africa Director and UNDP Africa Director Ahunna Ezeakonwa. He also will be speaking with Tim Stranahan, a former FBI cybersecurity expert, on how Africa can learn from the American example to combat cyber crimes. Check out Peter's interviews on voanews.com or wherever you listen to VOA. And thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.